Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 51.
Pozuiti. Japanese.
This past week, we saw quite a few shows.
We did.
We kicked it off with Big Apple Circus's 40th anniversary show.
We did.
What'd you think, Lindsay?
Well, we'll talk about more on today's podcast. But, you know, all in all, I was surprised at how similar it was
to previous years.
It didn't really feel any different. You know, the lighting was a lot better than I've ever seen it. And our friend Jeff Kreuter did the lighting. And it's not because he's our friend that I'm biased by it, but it genuinely is really good lighting. But it just felt really similar. I also
like the sort of like where the bandstand was really good this year. And yeah. Thought the carpet, it's like this beautiful blue carpet, looked really, really nice.
Yeah, the bandstand was good. And, you know, the theme was there was no theme, really. It was like New York, we're back. In that sense, really like a traditional circus.
Yeah, I mean, arguably more traditional than in years past when you go with a theme like that. Because we're teasing a lot of what we're going to chat with Mark Lonergan later on. He directed the show. Mm-hmm. But the idea of this thing being let's celebrate 40 years and get the best possible acts and really feature the acts as acts without really anything on top of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the costumes were kind of all over the place. Mm. It didn't really have like a streamlined look to me.
Yeah.
As well as the music, it did feel like it was a lot of pop songs that were covered by the band and then some like original, you know, Peter Bufano music, which is always really good. But I think like overall as a listener of the show, it didn't have like a real flow to it.
No, not really musically.
No.
Having said all that, they really did nail the getting really, really good acts theme. There were two acts in particular that really blew me away. The one that really blew me away was the Flying Trapeze Act. They had this four-person group from Argentina, the Tuzniziani family. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And one of the guys is a quadruple backflip, which apparently only 9 people have ever accomplished in the history of flying trapeze. And he caught it on his first try and really caught it. We posted it to Instagram, so you can check it out there. Awesome being able to see such a rare trick really in a circus tent.
Yes.
You know, we saw them try to do it at Ringling and miss it. So, you know, it's kind of cool to see it.
3 times at Ringling and missed it.
Exactly. And then, of course, there's also Nick Walenda's famous family high wire act. We talked about that back in January, but now it's in New York. It was cool to see that in person. Our friend Eric Allen is in it. He did great. It looked like a cool, scary, thing I wouldn't personally want to do, but...
No, for sure. There's this girl in the act. They do it, I guess... It's 2 guys, Nick Walenda and another guy in the troupe, and they come out on bikes, and they have
like bikes on the wire.
Bikes on the wire, and they have a thing over their shoulders that's a bar, and then this girl is on the bar on a chair.
And then stands on the chair.
And then stands on the chair.
Balanced on the bar.
Like, you know, really on a high wire. And that, I was like, this is a little, you know, like... I don't know, tempting fate, but I mean, she looked super like solid up there. And but basically the whole act, I was just like, okay, I can't wait for this to be done because I'm just nervous.
It was great though to see Barry Lubin back in the ring, who
Barry,
is grandma.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about grandma at all with Mark in the interview, I just realized. So we can talk about it now. It was really cool to see grandma back.
And he and Joel Jeske, who's his clown partner, did a hilarious water spitting act.
It was really good.
You know, water spitting is one of my favorite genres of clowning, and these two guys are masters and get soaked. Yeah. Truly, truly soaked.
I saw grandma when I was like, you know, 10, when I would see the Big Apple or Ringling. And if I could tell my like 10-year-old self that, oh, actually, like you... Well, know grandma and take a photo with her and know her. I think I would have felt really cool to my younger self.
Well, that's good. We won't talk about Big Apple too much more on the pre-show, just because we're going to spend 50 minutes interviewing Mark Lonergan, the director, and we talk all about it, how it was created, what happens in the show. Stick around for that.
We also saw a burlesque festival this week.
The burlesque festival.
The first time we've ever been to it.
And you might be asking yourself, what is burlesque?
What is burlesque?
Well, it's a version of burlesque. And for people who don't know what burlesque is, it's comedy and theater and often involves taking off your clothes to some degree. And with boylesque, it's just men who are doing it, which is kind of a twist on the what most people know it is. Men have been doing it as long as women have. But typically you think of women with feathers and maybe pasties and something that's got more of that flavor. And these are all men performing all weekend. We must have seen like 25 dudes who ranged from like very, very feminine and pretty to like big, burly, overweight, hairy dudes. Yeah. And it was a pretty cool weekend. I mean, like anything, when you see 25 performances, some are going to be really, really good. Like our friend Monkey, the evil hate monkey, was in it, who was amazing. And then there was stuff that wasn't so good. There was one really interesting piece the first night. The first night of the festival was at Club Cummings, which is Alan Cummings' club in the East Village. And there was a guy who did a very, very political piece where he was wearing, I don't know, 10, 12 layers of shirts. And on each shirt was different things that said, like, Jew, or said Black Lives Matter, or said different, like, liberal causes, essentially. And the song, I think maybe it was David Bowie or something, and it was just, like, it really worked politically for something that is essentially just taking off your clothes. His performance and just the story was... It's really cool to see how you could do something so political in what is traditionally such a silly, kind of lighthearted discipline.
Yeah, I mean, watching all those people right after one another, you also can tell, like, who is really seasoned and understands, like, audience interaction or, like, just, like, gauging the audience's energy.
And those who listen to the podcast might be asking themselves, why are Josh Lindsay going to a boylesque festival?
My mom sure was asking that question.
The answer is because we're working on a show that we're going to try to do this winter or spring that is a really high-end variety circus cabaret show that will probably have a little bit of boylesque
in it. Probably, yes. Most likely.
Most likely.
So... there you go.
There's one other artist I just want to say before we switch on to another topic named Chris O, who is a, I guess, a very famous New Zealand boylesque performer. But his background is classical ballet. And he did like a lot of cool stuff on Point. And he was just ripped. So like anything, when you see somebody who is like super in shape and like the control of their body, particularly with like all the active flexibility that ballerinas have.
Yeah.
Just the technique that's added to the storytelling of burlesque can be so great. There's also on this sort of same topic, a former named Topher Bousquet, who did contortion and hula hoop in the boylesque theme, which also got really, really well received. I think he was originally trained at NECA. But it's interesting to see how like when you can bring in like super high level technique, whether it be dance or circus, to sort of this burlesque comedy storytelling devices and things that genre can do, you really can get some cool scenes and acts and you know, 4 to 6 minute pieces.
Those are the acts that everyone in the audience was like, yeah, you know, it's like, because watching someone have the skill of a burlesque act plus like really amazing physical skills, I think really elevates the art form and like really brings it to a different place that I really enjoy watching. That's like my favorite. But anyway, it was really fun. And, you know, people were like, why are you at a boylesque festival? But I had a great time.
We saw one other show this week, Palabolas. And we saw it at the Queen's Theater. And, you know, this might be not...
I didn't even know it existed.
I don't think many people know it existed. And for those who don't live in New York, I'm sorry if this is a little bit too New York specific, but the Queen's Theater is in Flushing, which is where Citi Field is. That's where the Mets play. And also where Arthur Ashe Stadium is. That's where the U.S. Open happens.
And for those people who know what the State Fair is, that's where the State Fair was.
And it was really cool. I mean, the theater was really cool.
Or it's where they filmed the Men in Black, like,
oh, yeah, the first
alien disc things.
Yeah, exactly. If you've seen the first Men in Black, the UFOs are like part of the observation decks there.
Yes.
So the bottom of those UFO observation decks is this theater, the Queen's Theater. which is must have been there for a while. The whole lobby is this sort of like glass cylinder, and the theater's sort of feels like a little bit more like old school, built in the 50s, 60s kind of theater. Seats maybe 300. But it was this little gem hidden in Queens.
Cute.
We saw Palabolas, which is a very, very famous dance company. It's been around for about 40 years. We sort of saw like a best of recent work, which was surprisingly quite different from what I'd seen before. Palabolas was maybe one of the first dance things I ever saw as a teenager, and it blew my mind when I saw it because they do so much acrobatics in the dance.
Yeah.
I remember I went to a talk back. And my, you know, question as a 16-year-old wasn't like, how did you make that? Or what was behind that? It was, how did you learn that flip? You don't do that in gymnastics. And there was some cool dance acrobatics this time around. I did think that the themes, not too dissimilar from Big Apple Circus, was kind of all over the place, act mm-hmm. to act to act. Mm-hmm. Some acts were really, really like contemporary and silly. And then you'd have some acts that were like very moody and dark and almost more adult in tone, which I guess makes sense if it's like
and
a dance.
And a lot of projections. I mean, it's hard to, the show's kind of hard to watch because I think maybe if you're a really big fan of Palabolas and have seen everything, it was probably really fun to watch that because you maybe have seen those pieces before. But for someone who, like myself, who has never been exposed to Palabolas, seeing like little, like, I don't know, 5 to 10 minute
snippets
was like not super easy to watch.
No, I was, and also, you know, I think you and I were anticipating seeing a full length cohesive show when we were a little surprised by the fact that it was sort of these snippets and scenes. So, it was interesting. Another dance show, down on our belt. I would definitely go see Palabolas again, but probably look for something that's a full piece.
So, warning on for this pre-show and for today's podcast, both Mark Lonergan, our guest today, and myself have a cold. So if we sound a little nasally, it's because of our cold.
So our guest today is Mark Lonergan. He is a circus and physical theater director, originally from Canada. He moved to New York and started a company called Parallel Exit, which is a 3-time Drama Desk Award nominated nonprofit, which creates physical theater and comedy shows. He also has recently been directing Circus Mercus the past 2 years. And this year was his second year directing Big Apple Circus. We talk about that transition from directing theater to directing circus. We talk about what it's like to direct Big Apple Circus, the difference between what it was like and when it was a non-for-profit and when it was a for-profit, and, you know, Mark's thoughts on circus and theater in general.
So if you like our podcast, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Hideaway Circus. That's our handle. I don't think we've ever said our handle.
No.
Our handle is at Hideaway Circus.
Our handles for everything are at Hideaway Circus.
So follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, rate us on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com, and make sure to tell your friends about the podcast. Listen with some friends. Holds a podcast party.
Oh, yeah, hold a podcast party.
Hold a podcast party. That'd be fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a kind of a fun live thing, a podcast party.
Although, when you're having a podcast party, you would just be sitting.
All silently listening.
I mean, hey.
I mean, people used to do that. They'd tune into the radio, listen, you know.
It's true. I assume
there are people, rooms full of people who are just sitting there silently listening to this podcast.
Yeah, maybe also like, you're like, wait, don't tell me.
They do that live.
Yeah, but you could do a podcast. You could do a podcast party with ours.
Yeah.
Anywho,
enjoy our interview with Mark Lonergan. So, Mark, you're Canadian, right?
Yes, I am.
Where in Canada are you from?
I'm from English Canada, which is very different. And I say that to circus people because it's a totally different thing. If I was from French Canada,
right. You
would maybe understand my interest in circus. English Canada, there was virtually no circus whatsoever when I was growing up or even when I was in college.
Did you grow up in a city like Toronto or a little town? Or
nearby,
a suburb
of Toronto, about half an hour away. Yeah, it was called Milton. It was a town of 30,000 then. It's now a town of almost 200,000, I guess. It's like totally blown up since I left. But it felt very small and very insular when I grew up there, even though Toronto, which is the biggest city in the country, was half an hour drive away. We might as well have been on Mars. We might as well have been in another country.
Were your parents artists? Is that how you got into theater?
No, not at all. My dad sold insurance. My mom worked with him in the business. I have On my mom's side, a great aunt who was a visual artist and a teacher. And I have a cousin who runs a community theater in Toronto. So I had a little bit in the extended family, but other than that, no.
So you were mostly just as a kid in theater as opposed to circus, right?
Yes.
Were you doing like musicals and plays in high school?
Oh, yes.
And acting?
What was your first musical where you were like, I love this?
My first musical was Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh.
Nice. That's a good one to start with.
I played Mr. Mushkin, the guy who owns the shop.
You did? I would have pegged you as a Seymour.
You would think, right?
Yeah.
I had a big fat suit to be like this older sort of roly-poly guy, which looks ridiculous because it's my build, just with a giant like pillow in the torso. I was never really a singer. I don't think I ever really was great at that, but I loved it for sure. You know, yeah.
What did you study in college?
Acting, theater.
You did acting.
A straight conservatory program. The program I went to is York University. I call it the NYU of Canada. It's very much like that. It's very well respected, and it's within a university setting, so you get a degree, 4-year program. Very intense. I mean, it was like a conservatory, but also academics with it.
So what kind of style of acting did you study?
It was very method-based, very Stanislavski, very much they wanted you to be real. They wanted you to be very authentic. It was not classic, like Shakespearean. It was not stylized. It was very, very, almost like you wanted to go out and become a film and television actor. Not me personally, but you very well could with that training.
Mm. What did you want to do, like when you went to acting school?
I knew when I was in high school, I was already writing plays and directing them. So crazily, I was writing, directing, and performing in the plays all at the same time because I was an ambitious small town kid. What else was I going to do? And so I knew I wanted to do all of those things. But I studied acting first because I felt like even if I was going to direct, I wanted to learn the craft. I wanted to understand it and be able to speak to actors in that way. So
you knew you wanted to be a director?
Yeah.
What did you like about it when you were doing it in high school? What was like the appeal?
For me, I was interested in being able to make bigger decisions. And I knew I was so interested in experimental theater. So I would read plays by Richard Foreman or Robert Wilson. I would look at his work and all of these avant-garde, usually actually American theater artists, and I knew that I wanted to do something. I just didn't know what. I just wanted to do something not typical. I didn't want to do, like, we're all sitting at a couch
complaining about family living room drama.
Did you grow up, like, watching Charlie Chaplin and, like, the classic black and white physical comedy things, or did that come later?
When I was very young, in second grade, we got matched up with older kids, like they do in a lot of schools. So I think there was an eighth grade buddy.
What? I've never heard of that.
I did that.
Really?
I had a little, like, second or third grade.
You had a buddy?
Yeah.
I've never had a buddy.
You even helped them get out of the car in the morning when their parents drove.
What?
It's a great idea because you get, like, a mentor in that way. And then the older kid gets to really kind of look after.
Be nice to you.
Yeah, it's great. So I can't remember how it happened, but I was always walking around like Charlie Chaplin. How I even knew to do that at age 7, I have no idea. And so they would call me, oh, look, it's Charlie Chaplin coming down. I don't even honestly know how I absorbed that. But at a young age, I knew I was interested in him. But I didn't really touch it again until I had graduated theater school, honestly. It was then that a friend of mine, it's a whole long story, he actually lives here in New York now. He's going to be in one of the projects I'm doing with Parallel Exit. We'll get to that. He introduced me or reintroduced me to Chaplin, Keaton. He was obsessed with this. And he said, Mark, I think based on the kind of work you're doing, you would really take to this. And as soon as I got back into that, it was the perfect place. It was
this. So what brought you to New York, though, from Canada? What was like, I want to go to America and do theater?
So, again, because I was from English Canada is a great place to be an artist if you find you sort of mesh with what kind of work is going on there. And I never did. I felt so kind of restless because, again, in English Canada, nobody was doing like silent physical comedy. That very, very little clown. There's two guys, maybe you've heard of them, called Mump and Smoot. They were kind of the kings of the Toronto clown scene, but it was very tiny and very insular. And I myself didn't want to perform as a clown, so I wasn't really following that. I really wanted to create original work. And I felt like there, I was never going to kind of fit in really with what was going on. And so I came to New York. I saw Bill Irwin and Blue Man Group on my first trip here.
Oh, wow.
And I said, if this is possible here, then I have to come here. And I got a grant from the Ontario Arts Council. They still have, you know, government funding there in a good way, to come and study at the theater here on 6th Avenue, that downtown space. Mm. In Soho, mm-hmm. with a director who runs that space, Kristen Marting. And she was doing very interesting physical theater, and that's why I chose her. And I was here, and at the same time, a show I had done in Toronto was accepted to the very first year of the New York Fringe Theater Festival. So I came with both of those things back to back. We brought this show to the Fringe Festival. It was very well received. It was the first parallel exit show, if you will, that was here.
Is that Exit Stage Left, or was there something before that?
No, before that. It was called White Noise Jump, and we got a big photo in the New York Times, and so all of a sudden we felt like, oh my gosh, well, we should keep doing this. And for several years, I would go back to Toronto, and I would create something, and I would bring it here for a short run in a tiny theater. You know, at that time, all these theaters in the Lower East Side were still open and running, and they've all since, of course, closed down, but there was a whole kind of scene there for young, ambitious people who were trying to do something not Broadway, to do something different. Mm. And that's where I was sort of landing.
So when did Parallel Exit go from like the vehicle you used to make like your first show or two to like this company that like makes physical theater work and has multiple shows going and is a nonprofit?
We did that in about 2005. It's when I started partnering with Joel Jeske. Joel, for some of your listeners, they will certainly know who he is, a clown and a circus performer for many years.
He's in Big Apple this year.
So how did you guys meet? How did you and Joel meet?
Michael Bongar, who's
an agent
to many performers. He was our matchmaker. Oh. He was our you know, our, what's the woman in Fiddler on the Roof?
Yenta?
You know? Yes, correct. He knew that Joel was, again, ambitious. Joel was trying to perform, write, direct, design, produce all of his own shows. And Michael said, Joel, I think maybe it would be good if you had someone to help you because you're trying to do too much. And Joel recognized that. And then he and I met and I worked on a showcase of something he was doing, a vaudeville piece that was kind of a precursor to Exit Stage Left that you, Josh, referred to. And from there, it just felt like, well, this is a perfect partnership. He is endlessly creative. The ideas that come out of him never stop. And my role really with him is to kind of take all of that energy and channel it somewhere specific and realize some of those ideas so that they don't just go off into the ether. So it's a very good partnership that way. So about 2005, we started working together, and it's been that way ever since.
What's like the mission of, how do you describe Parallel to somebody who hasn't seen any of your work?
It is a nonprofit, and so we say we're trying to take variety arts to a wide audience, a diverse audience. So along with the original shows that we do them in New York City, we also travel and tour internationally, but we do school programs, for example. We'll come into a school and Joel and a couple of my other performers will do a clown show for an entire school assembly, for example. And many of these public schools have never seen anything like this and they just go bananas. They love it. So we do that, and we also we have a series that we do occasionally called Move It, which is a free performance series of other physical theater artists. So what we're trying to do is take the art form of physical theater and make it more accessible and make it more meaningful and more just more significant in New York City. That's our goal.
Well, it's been successful. You got 3 Drama Desk nominations for 3 different shows you guys have done.
We have. They've been very friendly to us, which has been great. We fit into that category of theirs, the unique theatrical experience category. We sometimes think that's the redheaded stepchild category, but it makes sense for us to be in that category because it's sort of undescribable in a way. If you're not familiar with physical theater, if you're not familiar with variety or vaudeville or circus, you can look at our shows and go, I don't even know how to describe what those guys do. So it makes sense they would put us there.
At what point in the trajectory did you start seeing more and more circus and go, oh, I see how these worlds collide and I think I can tackle that?
Early, I think in the 2000s when I was here, strangely, the first time I saw Cirque du Soleil, even though I'm Canadian, was here. And it was Kidam, that show. And I know probably many of the people you've talked to have spoken of this show as like a landmark. For me, it was a landmark because it was so visual, like just basically a Magritte painting exploding in the circus ring. And coming from that interests of artists like Robert Wilson or even Bill Irwin and all of that sort of wordless, very visual physical theater, marrying that with all of these incredibly skilled circus performers in that show in particular, which I think it's Franco Dragon's show.
I think you're right.
Pretty sure. I just thought it just blew my mind. And it was sort of embarrassing that the first time I saw Cirque du Soleil as a Canadian was in New York City. It made no sense. But it was that show that I said, okay, how do you combine all of that really rich, interesting visual theatricality with people who have these tremendous skills? How do you put those two things together? And for me, that show really achieved that.
How would you describe the role of a director on a physical theater piece where that isn't text? What are the differences between that and doing something like a super traditional living room play?
So for me, it is trying to figure out who is the chief creator. And if there isn't a chief creator, is it being done by the whole group? And I've gone back and forth with that. Sometimes in my group, Joel is the chief writer, if you will. And sometimes it's the whole group collaborating. And so we will try to come up with something on paper, a scenario, or a series of stage directions, because there's very little dialogue. And from there, say, okay, now we're in the room, now we're in a rehearsal studio, what are we going to do with this? And so it's very unlike doing a typical play or a musical where you have this very solid script you're starting with, and the performers are just trying to embody the characters and learn the scenes and all the rest. In this case, the performers take ownership over the material. So it's not just, oh, I'm playing this character, or I have to learn where my role fits into the greater whole. It is, I need to figure out what my role is here. I need to figure out what my character is even going to do. And there's a lot of improvisation. There's a lot of stuff that we will try and then throw away and then try something else. And for me, the inspiration on that is artists, my two favorite directors, who are Simon McBurney of Complicité and Robert Lepage, who now also does circus, but is mostly a French-Canadian theater director. And both of them talk about this all the time. They talk about how to create collaboratively without it becoming just like a watered-down, too democratic kind of thing where it becomes a mush. They're very good at saying, I've taken in all of your input, and now I believe this is where we need to go with it. So that, for me, as a young director, trying to learn the ropes, I read every single thing I could about their process and tried to absorb it as much as I could. And that's the process I've tried to apply with Parallel Exit ever since.
So you've been doing Parallel Exit since like around 2005 when you started the company.
In New York, yes.
How did you come up with the name?
There's no good secret there. It was purely, I had a bunch of random words thrown on my bed, honestly, because I didn't know what to call it. And I had some companies in Canada that had interesting names and some here that I was inspired by. And I just threw a bunch of words on my bed and I put those two together and I said, oh, that could work. And since then, we've talked about, oh, it could describe a little bit of what we do. Like it sounds like a physical theater technique or something like, oh, two people are going to exit in parallel to each other. But that's not really why we chose it. It was very random.
That's fun, though.
Yeah.
So jumping a little bit ahead in time, you are now like the go-to circus director in all of Northeastern America.
Wow. Wow. That's something.
I'll just drop that right there. I think it's true. How did the Big Apple first come about, the first time you directed it, not this past season?
So Joel, my creative partner, he had worked there quite a bit, both as a performer. He had hosted, which is their way of saying being a ringmaster, in 2005. And he had been a clown doctor with their hospital program, and he had taught for their after-school program. He had done all this work for them. And he came up with what he thought was an exciting theme. And he brought it to the then artistic director, Guillaume Dufresnoy, and said, "What do you think?" And Guillaume loved it. It was the theme which became the Grand Tour, which we did just a couple of years ago.
Which is like traveling around the world in a circus show.
Yes, in the 1920s, that whole feeling. And Guillaume said, "Well, Joel, this is great, but who is going to direct it? You know, what are you going to do?" And Joel said, "Okay, I'll introduce you to the person I've been working with for all these years." And then Guillaume came to see one of our shows. We did a performance at Symphony Space. Guillaume came to see it, and he liked it very much. And he liked Joel's clown partner, Brent Macbeth, also a member of our company. And he said, "I totally see this. I think Mark could direct it, and I think Joel and Brent could be the clowns in the show," which was great. And then he allowed us to bring the entire creative team. So I had a set and lighting designer, Marudi Evans, and I had a costume designer, Awana Botez, and my choreographer and associate, Antoinette DiPetropaolo, all these people I've been working with for years and years, and they said, "Bring them. This is great." And so that was really thrilling. It almost felt to us like we were doing a parallel exit show, because it was our team just happened to have all these other tools we could...
So you get to Walden, which is where Big Apple used to rehearse. You get to the tent, and then you get all these circus performers, and you're used to working with all these physical theater performers. Did anything surprise you about, you know, those kinds of, I'll say, actors in this case, or...
It's a good question. So we had just come off of doing a variety show with the GOP in Germany. GOP is for those who don't know, it's a variety circuit in Germany. It's not the Republican Party in America. So I had some good access to a trapeze performer, a tight wire artist, all of these other disciplines. So that was helpful, because the biggest change to go from theater, physical theater, whatever it may be, to working with circus artists is you have to understand their safety concerns, their need to be warmed up properly before they can do anything, even lighting their act to know so much time has to be taken to make sure they can see, that nothing's in their eyes. I think all of that was the biggest shift, to understand how do we keep these people safe? How do we support what they do in a way that an actor is not going to need? An actor doesn't, I mean, whatever. If
so, like, shine that light in that guy's eyes.
Yeah.
An actor, he'll be fine.
Yes, be totally fine. As long as he's not right at the edge of the stage, he's going to walk off. You know? So that was a big difference. And, of course, working with people, by that time, Joel and I had a stable of performers we had been working with over and over again. So to open up to all of these brand new performers was also a big shift. To go, okay, it's not our regular crew. But I found just trying to, as much as I could, to earn their respect was to show as much respect to them as I possibly could for their act, for their technique, their discipline, and their needs. That's been my approach, just to try to have them understand, I actually care that you're safe. I actually care that you succeed here, even if a decision has to be made that they will disagree with. And that happens. And it's difficult, as you guys know.
So, like, what genre, though, are you, like, does it be, like, their costume or the music? Or is it something more...
Yeah, it could also be we're editing something in the act. If we realize, you know, this trick you do here might be better in this part of the act. Mm-hmm. Or might be better if we take it out altogether. And for an artist who's been doing their act for years and years and years and know that it succeeds, that can be very difficult to hear. And I understand that. If someone told me that in their shoes, I'd feel the same way, you know. But trying to absorb what is going to succeed about their act in this particular show, mm-hmm. and understand that, I think is the director's job for the circus, to understand, I believe you should head in this direction with this specific part of your act, whether it's your costume or the music or an edit to the material. And I believe it will succeed better in this show. And it takes a great deal of trust to get people to sign off on that.
So then you go from working with these like seasoned adult circus performers in Big Apple to then working with the next generation teenagers performing in Circus Smirkus. What was that jump like doing the, is your title creative director or artistic director?
Creative director there. Troy Wonderly is the artistic director. So that was interesting and kind of a backwards way of doing it. Because here I was as, yeah, I've done some variety. I've worked with a lot of circus performers. But the only circus I had done before Smirkus was Big Apple Circus. It seemed like it would have made more sense the other way around in a way to get sort of a training in a way from Smirkus and then graduate up. So that was interesting to go in the opposite direction. But it was thanks to Josh Avner, who I'm sitting across from, that even happened, because I know they were looking for a creative director, and Josh, you were very kind to put my name in the hat.
Easy.
Actually, yeah. I was also part of the conversation behind the scenes.
Oh, that's great.
I was like,
that's
Mark nice. Would be great.
That's nice. Thank you for both of you for that.
So I get a shout out to
you. Nice. So the biggest shift then there, of course, and Josh, you know, having been a Smirko, is here are these kids who are immensely skilled, talented, and very dedicated, but they're teenagers. You know, they're not at the maturity level as a professional yet. They will be someday if they continue. And they spend 10 months of the year in school living in their parents' homes. They're not living in a professional environment until they come to Smirkus. And all of a sudden, they are thrust into this world where it's expected you will wake up at this time, you will show up to warm up, you will learn this opening, you will run your act, and if you're in another act, you will run the next one. And that is amazing to me. And what I appreciate about it is because they are the age they are at, there's very little opposition.
Resistance.
To, yes, to doing the work. And in this way, if you're working with an artist who's been doing their act for 10, 15 years a certain way, understandably, they're going to be resistant to change. It makes perfect sense. These kids aren't there yet. So for them, if we suggest something and they can achieve it, they are game immediately. Right. So there's...
They don't have an act that they've been doing for years and years and years.
No, and if they do, we probably won't put it in the show. Like, right. We may use some of their skill, but we won't put that exact act in. So, but then the second part of that, which is related to what I just said, is... Big Apple Circus, we have about 4 weeks to put the show together. Circus Smirkus, we have less time, and it's teenagers, and the acts have not been created until we show up. So it seemed to me to be impossible the first year.
Well, that's why I wanted you to do Big Apple first. Got to do the easy thing before you do the hard thing.
Obviously. I had to. That was my correct training ground. When I did it the first year, I constantly was sitting down with Troy or with Josh Shack, the production manager, and saying every day I would say, guys, really? This is how you do this? Really? There's no time for this, but somehow we're going to make it happen? And they would go, yes, Mark, don't worry about it. Don't worry. It all comes together at the end. I was just flabbergasted that in that tiny amount of time, they could create something virtually from scratch. There was a lot of prep going into it, obviously, but none of the music was composed till we showed up there. The kids have some of them barely met each other, and they're going to suddenly be partners in acts. It seemed insane to me. And then you get to those final days of rehearsal, and you realize, oh, it's going to come together.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
Like when we were doing Slumber, you know, that was like my first circus show being put together, and my previous experience had been theater where you do scene, you know, and then you do the first act and it feels very like achievable and you understand how it's getting put together. And then with Slumber, I was like, this is never going to come together. How? You know, and then you'd see dress rehearsal and you're like, that was awful. And then the first show, you're like, oh my God, how did that work? You know?
Circus is, I mean, theater, of course, you require an audience just to make it feel like it's a piece.
Right.
But circus even more. When you're doing circus, by the time you get to the end of the process, And everyone's looking at each other like, oh my God, this is so tiring and it's so much work and we're not getting any energy because there's nobody here. And everyone just, you know, is looking at disdain with each other and at the director often. And I get it. And then the first audience comes, as you say, Lindsay, and suddenly you go, oh, that's what it's supposed to be. Oh, I get it. Yeah. Especially the clown. If there's any right. comedy, oh my God.
Well, also yeah. with circus, it's like, you know, it's not like you have a song or a scene where the audience is pretty quiet through it. And then it's at the end. It's like through each act, you have claps and yeah. like the tricks. And without that feedback, it just feels like, oh, this isn't going anywhere. And then you hear it. You're like, oh, I get where this show is going. And
yes. Yes.
Where the ebbs and flows are.
It truly feels dead yeah. until the audience comes. Yeah. And then you go, oh, right. This is a live piece of art. And now I see what it is we're yes. doing. Yeah, absolutely.
So now you just finished your second summer with Smirkus, right?
Yes. So 2016 was the first summer. That was Up, Hup, and Away, the show based on aviation. It was Troy, the artistic director. It was his dream show forever and ever and ever to do. And I was happy to give him his wish. He was obsessed with the Wright brothers and the beginning of flight even as a thing. And so that theme was really fun. And then this past year, which is the 30th anniversary, Troy said, I want to do something where we can take characters and acts from almost anything. And so the theme being Midnight at the Museum, kind of a takeoff of the Night at the Museum books and movies, gave us a tremendous amount of freedom just yeah. to go kind of anywhere, which was fun. And then Troy was able to make some references. Josh, maybe you saw some of them to past Smirkus shows.
Oh, yeah, Josh's like, that's from this year. That was from that year. That's I was like, right. okay, chill out.
That's right. And it was really important to Troy to have those for alumni and for audiences who've been there forever to go, oh, isn't that nice? And for audiences who don't know that.
Yeah,
know,
I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah, and it still is
it
fine.
It still worked, right.
But that was the thought behind that, was to have something that really could reference past things and kind of go anywhere and everywhere.
Mm. That's cute. Yeah. I mean, these yeah. past 2 years, I saw Smirkus when I was, like, younger. My parents would bring me. And then I hadn't seen it since, you know, forever. And then Josh obviously brought me back to it.
Yeah.
But these past 2 years have been so good. Like, I was just blown away. I think my first year, though, was before you directed it.
Probably.
Yeah. But it must be an interesting challenge not being able to really cast the show yourself. Because every year you'll get kids who audition and then you're going to take the best from that. And yes. then you work with that
yes.
as your base as opposed to, say, Big Apple, where you go, okay, I know I want a teeter board and I know I want a juggler and I
That's
know
right.
I want this.
That's right. In fact, I'm looking at the audition videos today for the next season of Smirkus as we speak. And you're right. You have to take what is being offered and you go, okay, great. So we have four performers who can juggle. Okay. And we have three who can do single point trapeze. Okay. So then you assemble the show from that as opposed to, you're right, what feels like the more proper way to say, these are the acts that I would like. And now I need to go and find them, which you would do in an adult professional setting. So yeah, it's challenging. And this year, oh my gosh, almost half of our troupe graduated last summer.
Oh, wow.
We have, I think, at least 14, maybe 15 spots available this year out
oh,
of
wow.
a 30-person cast. And so we really don't know what we're going to get until we finish the auditions.
Exciting.
When are the auditions?
January, middle of January.
I'm going to try to come this year.
Wait, we're going to go last year, then we were going to Australia.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. But, oh,
yeah. We're just doing well thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're definitely going to come.
It's so fun, that audition day. I mean, Josh, you know from having done it yourself.
I watched his old audition.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's amazing.
I'm going to show you my audition tape.
Oh, my gosh.
It's actually the most with you and Seb.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
It is wonderful.
I would love it.
It's my best thing I've ever seen. I was like, this is incredible. But it is awesome seeing all the kids, like, they're just so much more talented than you would think.
Yes, they are. And anyone who hasn't seen Smirkus, I always try to tell them, I'm still the newbie there. I'm you know, Troy's been there forever. And Jesse Dryden, who was there before me, was there for many, many years. So I still feel very much like the rookie. But when I tell people about it, I say, I know you think it's going to be like, oh, a cute little presentation. And aren't the kids great? They're trying hard. Good for them. And of course, as you know, it is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
You're going, this is basically a professional show, and I can't believe how young these kids are. It's
Insane.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you're doing, so you got the pleasure of doing the last nonprofit Big Apple show and yes. the first for-profit Big Apple show.
Yes. Yes.
So now you're doing that show and it's no theme really. It's just,
correct.
We're back.
Correct. And it's an interesting dilemma because last time we did this, which was the end of the nonprofit era of Big Apple Circus, that show, The Grand Tour, was very themed, heavily themed. And I appreciated that about it. It was Joel's creation, and I really liked that about it. And the new owners, Neil Kahanovitz, who's the chairman, and Michael Cooper, the CEO, this year were very clear about saying, let's do something where the real story is we're back. The real story is it's the 40th anniversary. And anything on top of that might feel like it just is a distraction. And that was a challenge for Joel and I, honestly, because we were so used to Big Apple Circus having a very rich theme. And so then the challenge became, okay, if that is what we're going to use as the basis for a show, and if therefore the acts are going to be the central focus, how do we create something where it is a direct line from the audience to the acts with no barrier, nothing in the way? You just finish one act and within seconds you are in the middle of the next act, so that people can appreciate, I think more than anything, just the art form in its purest way, mm-hmm. which was a very different goal than doing something that's really themed and has any type of real narrative to it. And a big challenge for us to feel like, how do we make that work?
Well, before we get into too much specifics of what happens in the show,
yes.
I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the difference between the rehearsal and creation process between the nonprofit version and the for-profit version.
Thankfully, they were very good about asking, the very first big meeting we had, asking, how much time do you need? And Guillaume Dufresnoy, who was the artistic director, now is an advisor on the show, was very clear about saying, this is how much time we need. We need 5 weeks, including previews. And I was, because I was the new guy in that room, I was saying, well, you know, maybe. And Guillaume was like, no, we need 5 weeks. He was very adamant. And thank God he was. And so the time was virtually the same in terms of the actual rehearsal process. But leading up to it, when we did the previous incarnation, we had 2 years to prepare. We knew we were going to do the grand tour 2 years in advance. And that was the rotation that they were on because they knew it takes that long to assemble all the acts, to really come up with the design, to make everything cohesive, at least for the Big Apple Circus. And this time we had 8 months. And the work did not get any easier or smaller. It just took two years.
Just had to happen faster.
Yes. 2 years of work into 8 months, and there was nothing any of us could do about it. So that part was very different. And that was just purely the circumstance more than anything else. That's not even necessarily that it was for profit rather than nonprofit. It just was what it was.
Did you feel like you had more or different responsibilities between the first time and the second time?
I felt, because the owners were new to the Big Apple Circus, that along with Guillaume, I felt part of my role was to try my best to talk about the original spirit of the Big Apple Circus and try to retain that as much as possible. Even though, as they should, they wanted to have it feel not exactly the same as the old Big Apple Circus. So that was an interesting responsibility, to feel like I was trying to preserve something that the founders, Paul Binder and Michael Christensen, had originated, while at the same time recognizing the new kind of direction they wanted to go in. And this year in particular felt like kind of a mix of the two. You've got stuff where you feel like, oh, Grandma is back and Joel is there and Jenny Vidbell doing horses. That feels very familiar yes. to the existing audience. And then acts that have never been there before, and even types of acts or style of acts that are a little bit outside the usual for Big Apple Circus. And I'm curious to see what will happen next year. They may go in a completely different direction next year on purpose. But this year was, I think, the bridge to say, let's make sure the existing audience doesn't feel alienated, but let's make sure we're also reaching out to others.
Something that's was so interesting for me watching Big Apple last night is that, you know, like we've been recently really like seeing a lot of contemporary circus performers, right? Where the like the whole their whole aura is just different than yes. traditional family circus performers. And the one thing I just love about traditional circus performers is like their styling, where they're like, yeah. The snaps and like yeah. the winks into the audience and yeah. the like shoulder moves. Yeah. Like, oh my God, I love this so much. It's just something that you don't see ever.
Yes.
You know?
Particularly, you're right, in contemporary circus that yes. you wouldn't want to do that. In a more traditional circus like Big Apple, it's exactly the right thing.
Yeah. Do. And, yes. if like, it really gets the audience like on your side, yes. on their side, you know? And like the juggler
yes.
we're talking about, like he missed his... a bounce juggling trick.
Yeah.
With a seven
But he got it the third time.
And he tried it three times. And yeah. everyone was like, he has so much charisma.
Yes.
And everyone was like, you can do it. I know.
But you were telling us afterwards that you'd hired a few people and did not realize they were family before you'd hired them.
Yes. So he, the juggler, who you're right, he did exactly that. And it's so great when the whole tent is basically on the side yes. of the performer, just rooting for them to yeah. succeed. I love that. It's the best
thing. It really is. It's something you don't get in theater.
No, no, definitely not. And then, so he is brothers with the roller skater. So his name is Gamal Garcia. And then the roller skater is Dandino, I believe also Garcia. And then the featured flyer in the trapeze act is Ahmed Taniziani. And they're all, I can't quite figure out how they're all part of the same family, but they're all brothers. Mm. So I know that. And some of them have Taniziani as the last name, which is the famous flying act name. Some of them have Garcia. You would have to ask them about all the lineage of yeah. that. But it's a circus family that they're mm-hmm. all coming from. And yes, they were cast in the show, and it wasn't until I met Ahmed, the flyer, that I even knew they were brothers. I had no idea. And I said, for them, what an amazing experience to basically have a year-long run of a show with your brothers.
Right.
And their kids and their spouses. And
it's oh my God, like their kids are so cute. Last yes. time when we went backstage to see Eric Allen, who is a wire walker with the Walenda family wire walkers.
Yes.
They were all just playing outside, like all like four or five of their kids. And I was like, what an amazing experience as a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
Just be on the back lot of Lincoln Center in New York City.
Yes.
And, but yeah, I mean, it was, they're just, and that flyer, man.
Yeah. First time I've ever seen anybody catch a quadruple backflip. I've seen people try it multiple times on flying trapeze and yes. miss, and try it three or four times live and miss. Last yeah. night, dude nailed it. First try.
He did.
Yeah, Josh awesome. Was fangirling. He was like, hey, Lindsay, will you take a photo of me and him?
Well, I was like, how many times am I going to, like, have the chance to stand next to somebody and get a photo? Yeah.
It's true. It's you know, true.
Yeah. Autographs used to be the thing, but now it's all about the, yeah. the selfie.
That's right.
And so,
right.
and then you also have the Walendas.
Yes.
In the
show. So, and the Big Apple Circus would want me to say that it's very rare that you're going to have someone try the quadruple somersault and someone do a seven-person pyramid in the same show.
Yes.
There's a reason why that's rare, which we learned in rehearsal, which is the rigging for both of those acts.
It's crazy.
Is crazy. They don't necessarily go together.
No. I was so impressed last night. I was like, oh my God, they got a good rigger for this.
Yes.
Because there's so many things that are just almost crossing.
Yes. It took so much time to figure it out. It was really... Nick Walenda himself is a genius at his own rigging, and he's yeah. very particular, as he should be, for safety, right? And he and Dieter, one of his guys, kind of oversee all of that. And he has a whole team of people that help him. And then Ahmed, with his brothers used to also be flyers, they kind of oversee all of their rigging. And they're both doing things that have not quite been attempted by them before, just to fit in the tent, to fit on Lincoln Center, to fit together with this other crazy big act. Yeah. So it was a lot of experimenting. It was weeks and weeks of on paper figuring out, okay, where's this going to go? Where's this right. go?
All the lines.
Yeah. And even with that, then they showed up and it took multiple days to figure out how do these two things go together. So in that way, there's a reason why usually you don't try to have two of these huge right. rigging acts in right. the same show. But what a treasure to have them
yeah.
both. It's amazing.
It's great. They close each act, right?
Yes, they close yeah. the first half with the flyers and the second half with the yes. high wire. Yeah.
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 And man, I was nervous. That whole, I mean, you guys do a very good job of building up the suspense.
Yes.
And you got me because I was like, oh no. And I was like, little Eric Allen is all the way up there on this high wire.
Yes.
I mean, but it's very impressive. I've never seen a, you know, a high wire act like that.
It's interesting because in Nick's family, they've been doing that kind of act for 200 years. I mean, it's a classic, classic circus act. And
the Germans originally, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And they're now, the whole family is mostly based in Florida. But they, you know, for them, doing a seven-person pyramid, although it takes a lot of rehearsal, a lot of work, it's almost normal. You know, right. Nick will talk about that. He'll say, I've been walking the wire since I was in my mother's womb. You know, this is nothing, you know, for him. But to find other performers like Eric and the other ones who are in the act who are willing to take that risk and do that is not easy.
Right.
So they famously, in the circus world anyway, in February, they have, were trying to do the 8-person pyramid, which is would be a world record. And it's something that has been attempted, to my knowledge, only by one other group in Monte Carlo. And they actually fell at Monte Carlo trying it. And in rehearsal, they were trying it and they fell. And until Big Apple Circus, they used no net, no airbag, nothing. They were just, the wire was up at whatever height, and they just took the risk to know if we fall, we fall. And Nick describes that as if they try to use a net, the fear is that they'll bounce out of it anyway, and it won't help them at all. So the airbag, which we use here, which New York State insists that we use as well, is important. And I think hopefully will help calm the nerves of people like yourself, Lindsay, feeling like, oh my gosh.
I know. I was like, safe? Josh, like, they have an airbag. But I still was like, that's a lot, that's a high fall.
It is.
And you have to find, like, also all the wires, the lines. Yes. You know, like there's a lot there.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
So are you guys using the bag for every show?
Good question. I mean, here in New York, yes, they will. But when they go on tour, it's, I don't know the answer. Honestly, it will be up to the production if they're going to continue to use it. They may want to use it because they've gotten used to it now and it works fine. Right. But other states won't necessarily insist that they use it. So it will be up to them.
So where's Big Apple going after New York?
I can't say officially. I just know that there are multiple cities they're looking at to tour. They want to tour all the way through the summer, which is what they have traditionally done. They haven't announced any of the cities yet, but you would recognize them from previous incarnations. Plus some new cities, which I think is great.
Yeah. Awesome.
Terrific. Yeah.
We'll definitely give that tour with a shout out once it's announced.
Absolutely.
So you told us last night you have a few projects in the works, both theater and physical theater and circusy related. Anything that you can tease a little bit for our listeners?
Yes. So for your circus folk listeners, I'm working with two different sets of circus performers right now. One is Kyle Driggs and his wife, his partner, not married yet, maybe someday, Andrea Murillo. And she's a dancer and he, of course, is a juggler and a great mover. So we're working on a project which combines their two disciplines, which I'm excited about. We're starting some work on it at Circadium, the new circus school in Philadelphia, where he's from originally. He's sort of the artist in residence there. And then I'm bringing in, back to New York, Alexander Koblikov, who was our juggler for the Grand Tour. Some of your listeners will certainly know who he is. He's amazing.
He also looked like, if you saw the show, he was like a sailor, like swaying. Yes. And he didn't drop once. No. I was like, dang, you're good.
He's so amazing. And that show is with a local juggler, Michael Karras.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And then with Eric Allen, who we've been referring to, not a juggler, but a wire walker and a strap artist. We're kind of combining their skills into a show. The concept of that show is just they're in a room and they can't get out. And they discover all this stuff while they're waiting to figure out where is the exit. It's like the theater piece No Exit, but with humor and circus. So
nice.
That's cool. The idea of it. And then a theater piece with the guy I referenced who turned me on to Charlie Chaplin as an adult, who's just moved here. His name is Scott McCord. He's an actor and a creator. It is truly a silent film for the stage. It is like you're watching a black and white classic Keaton or Chaplin film, but the actors are live in the room.
Yeah, on some of the silent films, they'd have like captions like, oh no.
Yes.
Are you incorporating that at all?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Correct. So we'll use projections for captions.
Oh,
like
and that's
that.
Why you liked the theater, because it has projections.
Exactly, yes. So that will be at the City Tech College in March. We'll do some performances there.
Here, do you know the name of it yet?
The final reel. The idea is this final reel of this old silent movie has just been rediscovered and it's going to be played for the very first time in 100 years tonight for the audience. And during the show, a little bit like The Purple Rose of Cairo, the Woody Allen movie, one of the characters steps out of the movie into reality, into 2017 or 2018 by that time, and has to decide if she wants to stay in the current time or go back into the film.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That's cool.
Are you going to do some sweet black and white costuming and stuff?
For sure. For sure.
Who's going to be in that show?
That will be Scott. One of my guys, Brent Macbeth, who is a clown on the Grand Tour. Shireen Hickman, who I've worked with before. She's a Cirque du Soleil clown. She's worked with them quite a bit. Darian Crago, who is a musical theater performer. You guys will love her, though. She looks like she stepped out of a 1920s silent movie. She's amazing. And she's so funny. She's great. And then Lucas Rooney, who's also a clown. Everyone is basically a clown in some way.
But good for that, you know, silent movie skills.
That sounds so awesome.
For sure. Yeah.
So I think we're at that point where we ask our famous last three questions.
Yes, I know these questions.
I'm even thinking about your answers.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Oh, great.
So the first one is, has there been a piece of advice, good or bad, that's stuck with you?
The best piece of advice, when I was still in Canada, I was doing my best basically like a painter would try to paint copies of, you know, master's work. I was doing my best to try to basically imitate my local theater heroes. Like, oh, I love that style of work. I want to do something just like it. And the best advice I got from an artistic director in Toronto was, Mark, you need to go somewhere else and experience other things before you can really figure out what your voice is as an artist. And it was that partially launched my excursion to New York City to come here and say, well, I've been in a kind of an insular place. I now want to see what the rest of the world has to offer. And for me, it was the best piece of advice because he was right. I didn't know what I truly was trying to do as an artist at that time. And coming here really helped a lot.
That's a good segue also for the next question, which is, is there a book or a movie or a TV show or a theater piece that you would recommend somebody who's just getting into this world experience or watch or read?
So if you're into physical comedy at all and you can find it, you can either find it at the Lincoln Center Performing Arts Library, or probably there's something on YouTube by now that's sort of pirated, is to watch my favorite thing that Bill Irwin's ever done, which is Fool Moves.
So good.
That show with David Byng, David...
Shiner.
David Binder. David Binder's a producer. David Shiner. That was in my first trip to New York. One of the first things I ever saw was a version of that show. And I've never experienced a response at the end of a show like that before or since, where people were on their feet, of course, and just the amount of joy. It was an audience clapping, going crazy, and basically saying, please don't leave the stage. Please keep going, you know. I've just never felt that way in a theater ever, except with
it. If it helps sell people to go to the library to watch it, there's also this amazing opening scene where David Shiner falls from
the balcony
into the audience, which I've also never seen done on Broadway anywhere like that.
It is so well done. That would be, I would recommend that to anyone. Yeah. Again, if you're into clowning or physical comedy at all. And then for reading, it'd be the two directors that I referenced earlier. Anything you could read that is process-oriented from Simon McBurney or Robert Lepage. They get interviewed quite a bit, sometimes in books, like books on directing, for example. Mm-hmm. And that, if you're interested in directing in a collaborative process, a process where artists are coming together to create something, whether it's circus or theater or what have you, I would recommend anyone look at that because they're geniuses at figuring out how to channel people and their material.
Okay, so last question.
Yes.
Who do you think we should have on the podcast?
Oh, gosh. So there's so many. So Joel, I would say for sure.
We should definitely have Joel.
For sure.
He was explaining to us last night about how, you know, there's like a whoopee cushion bit in Big Apple.
Yes.
And he was like, you know, the biggest difference between non-for-profit Big Apple and for-profit Big Apple, they bought us 6 different whoopee cushions to try which one was the best.
It's like, all nonprofit, it's 1 whoopee cushion. For profit, it's 6 whoopee cushions.
It's like, I love that. That's like what's giving him joy.
Clown experiments funded by a for-profit enterprise. Joel, for sure. my gosh, there's so many people that you could talk to. All the people that I reference, if I could spare you Alexander for an afternoon when he's here in town, great person to talk to, Alexander Kovlikov. And then Kyle would be great to talk to. I'm certainly any of the performers in the current Big Apple Circus. I think you guys are very good about this anyway, of finding people who are younger and who are doing something interesting with contemporary circus, if you will. And any of those people are certainly headed in that direction.
Well, thanks for coming.
Oh, Marcus, this is great. And congratulations on opening another super successful show at Big Apple Circus.
Thank you so much, guys.
And that was our interview with Mark Lonergan.
If you like our podcast, make sure to follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com.
Have a good week.